Thanks for listening today to Behind the Headlines. Please note we experienced technical difficulties at the very beginning of the show, but they did not affect the rest of the show.
What they did to help out, and especially in the rural areas, is that they did two things. They required the state to break up the map into geographic areas to reduce the drive time to these private dispensaries that we fully expect to be in the bigger population areas. If you're a private business owner, you're not going to put your dispensary in a place that doesn't have any residents. So obviously, that's the rub there. The other thing they did is they allowed medical marijuana to be delivered through the mail. Now they have to come up with a system to do that legally, or not legally, but also in a secure way. Obviously, mail brings other challenges. So for people in rural Utah who have some sort of illness that could be helped, alleviated with medical marijuana, that's the other way they can get it.
Is it legal to, I mean, at the federal level, to send medical marijuana through the mail?
That is a good question. I am not aware of any other state that does this. There might be places that, there's plenty of places that have delivery, but it's usually a private delivery. I mean, this is how states have got around this federal problem, is that they have a delivery system that is not touching the government. So I don't know the answer to that question completely. It's possible that this is through delivery and maybe not through the U.S. Postal Service.
These changes, you know, from the bill that lawmakers passed, which was already a tweaking of the voter passed initiative. So these new changes, are they roughly in line with what voters passed? I mean, are we going back to what the voters wanted under Proposition 2?
Yes, in some ways this is. I mean, it's not as easy or as widespread the private distribution that this would create, but it is steps back towards Prop 2. And they really emphasize, like, in an area of law this new, fully expect changes to be happening regularly with Utah's medical marijuana law. I would suspect every session we'll have some sort of bill that touches this, just kind of like we do with alcohol policy or any other big area. This is one that will be tweaked and changed frequently going forward.
New territory here for the state of Utah, and the fact that we even have a medical marijuana law on the books is in some ways, I think, maybe surprising, but that was driven by Proposition 2. I'm going to bring George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist, in on this conversation. And I don't know, George, what are your reactions to the idea that that we're changing a law that was on the books, that was a change to the proposition, and so on and so forth?
Well, an old Catskills joke about the guy who knows that if he comes home in the evening and the furniture is all where he left it, that means his wife rearranged the furniture twice. Sorry, old sexist joke. But it illustrates, I think, what we're doing here is that the people passed the proposition. I mean, the proposition got all the signatures it needed to get on the ballot, despite an awful lot of opposition. It was passed. Now, some of that opposition stood aside with the promise that, okay, we'll let them pass this, we'll let them have their fun and pass the proposition, and then the legislature will come in and fix it. Well, the legislature came in and fixed it by exposing themselves to being federal criminals, and they said, nah, that's not going to work. So they changed it again, back a little closer to what Prop 2 was in the first place, which could lead to the argument that we should have just left Proposition 2 alone, and that would be my argument. But they're moving there. I think it is to the legislature's credit that they have heard the people, that they have heard that people want to have available a plant that has been shown in many cases to alleviate suffering in ways that regular pharmaceutical methods either don't help or offer really awful side effects like opioid addiction. And so you get into the subplot of whether the opposition to medical marijuana is driven by people who sell opioids. Just don't want the competition. But some props to the legislature for sort of craning their ear a little bit to hear the people and move toward what we wanted.
Well, this is sort of a question for Matt Canham on the legislature, you know, having the special session, making these changes. Is that them acknowledging that what they had done was maybe a little bit of a mistake to have made those changes, or we're just figuring it out as we go?
No, I think it is an acknowledgement of a mistake, but it's also kind of, as George said, it's the legislature understanding that this is a law that the people want and trying to make it work. Part of the reason you do this in a special session and you don't wait till January mm-hmm. is that their goal is to have medical marijuana in the hands of patients by March 2020. Now, whether they meet that goal or not, I think is a little, I'm a little unsure. We'll see, but that's the intent here. The intent is to make sure that this process is in place. So if you're going to do that, you need distribution points. You need to figure out the delivery system. You need to get these places up and running so patients know where to go. You have to do that now. You can't wait. So it is a nod towards trying to make this a system that works. One other tweak they made that sure. I think is worth noting is they added in the law that a legislator cannot benefit from one of these distribution centers.
Why was that necessary?
There has been a lot of attention on one of the lawmakers who is a pharmacist in Cedar City, and he has got a ton of criticism that he's doing this just because he wants to benefit. And he put this in place to say, look, this is not what's happening. But they also, I think, interestingly, they set an expiration of January 2023. So if you're a lawmaker who wants to cash in on medical marijuana, you have to wait a few years, but you can definitely do it.
Well, or you could resign, I guess.
And, yes. You know.
How did proponents of medical cannabis react to the changes that lawmakers have made? Are they satisfied with what's happened?
They're split. There are someone like Connor Boyack, a libertarian with the Libertas Institute, who's been involved in this, is saying that this shows the state is serious about making this happen, that they have created an online portal where you can pay with a credit card or debit card and have it delivered to you, and that's very user-friendly, and this is the right way to go. You have Kristen Stenquist, an activist in this area who has really pushed the state to go farther than they have. She doesn't think that the number of these private, they call them pharmacy licenses for medical marijuana, are adequate. She wanted 20, which would have been the 7 private ones and the 13 local health departments, and they're only getting 14. She's worried about patient access.
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of the you know, being able to send it through the mail, get it, you know, order it online, is maybe trying to deal with that. Will you remind just one more time, when is this all supposed to roll out? You said it already once, but
yeah, patients are supposed to have access to this medication in March 2020.
Will there be enough, you know, product when the time comes?
That's a question too, because they've sent out the licenses, the agricultural licenses, but we really haven't had an update on. The actual, you know, product being produced. Because if these fleas are indoors, you can do that during the winter, right? But if your farm is outdoors, we are rapidly approaching a time period where marijuana will not be growing in Utah. And so what do you do by March? And I know that there's a mix of indoor and outdoor grow facilities. So we'll see how much. If that's a big question of if the product is going to meet demand or if there's too much product.
Any final parts of the story that we're missing before we head on to other news from this past week?
Just that there's going to be more changes, and the legislature had meetings where they talked about that too. Brian Chiazawa, a former state senator and a doctor, also presented to the legislature and said that there should be restrictions on who has access to this medication. His primary concern in this meeting was pregnant women, infants, and even young teens about the developmental impacts that medical marijuana can have.
And does he have he came with data, right? I mean,
he said it as fact. Our reporting did not, from Bethany Rogers, did not include data, but did say, I mean, other than the fact that THC, which is the chemical in marijuana, stays in breast milk for more than a week. So if a mother is nursing, that would pass on to the infant and could have impacts there.
George Pyle, any comments from you before we move on?
Well, just as I said, I mean, they're moving toward what the people wanted, catching up with other states. The next step, of course, is for the federal government to take marijuana off of Schedule 1 so we can do the kind of research that doctors and others who are not necessarily opposed to this are worried about, and so we can figure out what we're doing. We're having to do, because we kept the drug on Schedule 1 and out of legitimate laboratories for century, we are kind of flying blind on this.
Okay, that's George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a quick break in the show, and then when we come back, we will turn to some action over the Utah Inland Port that is taking place. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Next time on Ask Me Another, you're in for a double feature. From Netflix's She's Gotta Have It, we'll have actor DeWanda Wise. And Taye Diggs reflects on his role in the iconic film, How Stella Got Her Groove Back.
I have had people say, you are my grandma's favorite.
So join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on Ask Me Another, the answer to life's funnier questions.
Are you looking for a way to make your nonprofit organization more visible to our statewide community? Utah Public Radio's community calendar highlights events across the state, including music concerts, live theater, classes, workshops, art shows, lectures, festivals, volunteer opportunities, and much, much more. Just check out upr.org and head to our community calendar page. There you'll find our user-friendly submission link and the submission guidelines.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll while away a sultry afternoon in a Brazilian cafe as the warm sounds of acoustic bossa nova and samba float through the air.
O vento faz rendezvous no seu cabelo alinhado, acostumado com meu embolado.
I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Brazilian Cafe, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, reporter Taylor Stevens, and editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet us. We are at KCPW. Let's turn to some other news from this past week and bring Taylor Stevens into the discussion. And Taylor, you have been following the development of and opposition to the Utah Inland Port. This week, some of the opponents to that project called for state lawmakers to fund a health impact assessment related to the port. How did they make the request to lawmakers? What was the form that this request took?
Yeah, they held a news conference at the Capitol and, had a couple speakers. They talked, as they have several times, about some of the impacts the port could have, that they fear it could have on water, air quality, light pollution, traffic emissions, just a host of concerns that they have. And afterwards, they delivered a letter with some requests to legislative leadership, both to the House Speaker and the Senate President. Neither were there in person to accept the delivery of the letters, but they had representatives to take those.
So what is that? What is a health impact assessment? What does that even mean?
So this is a process defined by the World Health Organization. It's been used throughout the world kind of to evaluate the consequences of projects and policies on public health before implementation. And so opponents of this project, there are a lot of questions still about what this is going to look like, even kind of 18 months in since the state legislature created this project area through legislation last year. And so, they say we've got to have answers to these questions that we've had for a long time. You need to take action on this and provide us with a kind of full comprehensive look. One thing that they want is for this assessment to be independent. So they want it not only made up of members of the Inland Port Authority Board, which is tasked with overseeing development in this project area, but also from scientists, community members, affected neighbors. And so they really just want a comprehensive, independent look at, are these fears that they have about this project going to come to fruition?
Okay, so sort of neutral parties taking a look at this, as opposed to those who are pushing for the development of the port itself. I understand that you sought comment from the Port Authority Board, that is, and also from lawmakers on this. What kind of a response did you get in seeking comment?
Yeah, I'm nothing specific really to the ask at hand. Obviously, this press conference was really about this health impact study. And when I reached out to these parties, they kind of gave generic responses. The Inland Port said, you know, we care about the input of the public, and we're definitely going to include that as we move this project forward. However, they did not specifically address whether they would or would not do a health impact study. That may be something that needs to be up to the board. And so the executive director, it's possible, didn't feel comfortable speaking to that. However, I never got him on the phone to kind of ask any more questions.
This is a relatively new executive director of the project, Jack Hedge.
Yes, exactly.
And then lawmakers, I can't remember if you addressed that already.
Yeah, so I didn't hear back from the House, but a Senate spokeswoman said, kind of mentioned a health the legislature passed in this session a bill that will look at baseline impacts as a result of the port in kind of this northwest quadrant area. So while they did not address the health impact study, they said, you know, the legislature is looking to mitigate impacts and understand impacts as a result of this project.
But so far it sounds like, you know, not specifically saying, yes, we will do a health impact assessment, or no, we won't do a health impact assessment.
Exactly.
You know, while we're talking, there's a massive climate action taking place. There's a school strike or walkout around the country and around the globe, really. And the message there being, we're already really late in trying to avert the serious consequences that are in store with the level of warming that is predicted by scientists. The warming that they're expecting is driven by our dependence on fossil fuels and the fact that we're burning more than ever. That is something that opponents of the port were driving home. Can you talk about that aspect of their complaint about the port and how it relates to this health assessment, Taylor?
Yeah, obviously they have really hyper-local concerns about how this future distribution hub that's supposed to be on 16,000 acres in Salt Lake City's northwest side near the Great Salt Lake will impact neighborhoods and communities and Utahns. But they also do see this project as part of that bigger picture of contributing to fossil fuel emissions, to the rise in CO2. And they, you know, think that that's another reason why this project needs to pump the brakes. They say that we're already in a climate catastrophe, is what several people called it. So, you know, there's kind of the minutia of it, and then there's also the big picture, and they're sort of trying to bring out both about this project. One thing that I think is interesting, I sat down recently with the new executive director, Jack Hedge, and I asked him, because one of the big concerns of port opponents is that this project will be used to facilitate the transfer of coal. And, you know, he said that doesn't make sense in Salt Lake City. That's not part of the vision in Salt Lake City. However, the market will drive what's built. And in some of these satellite ports like Carbon County, for example, that could be part of the equation. So I think for opponents, they see kind of this bigger picture, and they're afraid because they don't really have a lot of answers right now.
Well, the market will dictate, you know, how this comes together, and what it does is right. That's not necessarily taking into account local input. That's just letting market forces dictate what you do. I'm just saying that because it's a great way to bring George Pyle, our editorial page editor and columnist, in on this. George, stopping, you know, this huge economic project is the goal of some of these, and they want to do that in the name of human well-being, of environmental well-being. That's at the local level, the ecosystem level, the global level. The forces behind this project talk about mitigating consequences and making it better than it might otherwise be, and then also talk about letting market forces dictate what they do. Those two sides seem kind of worlds apart, and this is a conversation I feel like we have all the time on the show.
Yeah, and that's why the concern that I've expressed and many other people have expressed is if you're going to let market forces work, and if you think that a transit hub port next to the airport, next to two major interstate highways, next to a rail line, is a natural thing that was probably going to happen anyway, why do you have to create this extra state port authority? Why don't you just let the city do it? And the only explanation that some of us can come up with is that they didn't trust the city to put real estate commissions ahead of air quality. And so if you are worried about that, you create some other level of government that you can count on to put money ahead of health. Now, not that they are necessarily going to completely ignore health, and they do have an argument that a state authority might have more power to worry about health if they choose to. What we don't know right now is whether they're going to choose to. And we don't have a plan. We don't have a business plan. We don't have a mission statement of any specificity. And so it really makes sense that people are saying, well, what are you guys doing? Why did you create this extra layer of government if not to ram through places that will pollute that the city might have tried to stop?
I mean, Taylor, the Port Authority Board does have all of the power here. I mean, they get to decide how this project goes forward. They could choose not to do this health impact assessment that's being requested. I guess, do you know if this group, do you think that this group, I guess, will get a response on the request for a health impact study from the board, or is it something that they can easily discard?
You know, we haven't had a meeting of the full port board in a few months since the last one ended in some arrests. And then there was the big protest of the Chamber of Commerce. That was not a meeting, but we haven't seen any meetings since that point. So I think it's really hard to say. Port opponents are just kind of trying to drive this conversation in the absence of action from the Port Authority and to kind of keep it top of mind, I think. But as to whether they will get any response on this, it's kind of unclear. I just want to go back to one thing you mentioned,
sure,
which is that the Port Authority has a lot of power here. One thing that they are really trying to drive home right now is that they don't own any land in the project area, and that their kind of role here is going to be using tax incentives to drive development that they want to see. They do say that they want that to be green, but as to just kind of a specific plan of how they're going to promote that or what that's going to look like, that's still to come. But, you know, they do say that that's one of their values and that they are taking input into consideration. So we'll kind of see what happens next. Hopefully they have a meeting soon and we'll get a better sense of what they've been working on the last few months.
Any sense of when that might be?
No, not at all.
Hey, you know, we're talking about a health impact assessment. What's happening on the environmental impact assessment front for the Utah Inland Port?
You know, I also tried to figure that out. That's something that Derek Miller, the chair of the Utah Inland Port, has mentioned repeatedly. You know, we'll do an environmental impact study as we do a business plan to kind of examine the possible impacts. However, I haven't heard anyone talk about it in a while, and I tried to get some answers on that, and again, was not able to speak with anyone from the Inland Port Board or the executive director to get a response on where that is right now. So there's just a lot of unknowns with this project at this point.
We could go into a whole topic here, but an environmental impact study would kind of involve National Environmental Protection Act and maybe add some further regulatory concerns for developers of the port. You know, I don't know if they want to create more red tape for themselves. I'm hypothesizing here, but you'll keep digging to see whether or not they're going to do that, I guess. Thanks, Taylor. Let us turn our attention now to some other news from this past week, and I'm going to go back to Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham for this next story. I'm just quickly going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet your comments and questions to us. Our handle is at KCPW. All right, Matt Canham, let's turn our attention now to the cost of renting in Salt Lake City. Some analysts from the University of Utah's Kim C. Gardner Policy Institute presented some data related to apartment construction here in Utah's capital city, and there is a lot of that going on right now. But that's not exactly having the effect on housing costs that you might expect. Can you kind of just walk us through this data, Matt Canham?
Yeah, this is it was presented this week, and the basic idea of our economic system is that if you increase the supply, then the demand, you know, is met and the prices go down. We've rapidly increased supply. In the last 20 years, we've added almost 9,000 apartments in Salt Lake City itself, not just the county, but in the city alone. And if you live in Salt Lake City or visit in any sort of regularity, you see it, especially downtown in that core area. There are apartment buildings all over the place, 4th South, you know, State Street, Main Street, downtown. There are big apartment buildings going up. And in that time, the average rents continued to climb. And that's still happening today, this last month. We're still having month-to-month increases. So rent in Salt Lake County as a whole in 2000 went from average rent would be $647 for an apartment.
That's in the year 2000?
Yeah.
Okay.
In Salt Lake County, it's $1,153 last year. In Salt Lake City, it's over $1,200 a month. And that's to rent. The same thing is happening in all of the metro area. It's a little bit less in Weber County than the rest. It's a little bit higher in Utah County because 20 years ago, Utah County didn't really have a lot of apartments. So they've had a huge growth in that area. But one of the city council people responded with, we can't build ourselves out of this problem.
Which has been sort of the strategy, right? I mean, trying to build as much new housing stock as you can with the hoped-for effect of driving costs down, and that's not happening.
Yeah, at least not yet. I mean, I think if you're a planner and you look at Salt Lake City, you realize that Salt Lake City itself could build up. There is places to have bigger buildings downtown, and that is clearly the strategy, and it's something the Downtown Alliance is cheering, that Salt Lake City is growing skyward. But that's not doing it. I mean, it does attract – there's certain businesses downtown that attract people who want that sort of urban lifestyle, who like the restaurants and nightlife in downtown Salt Lake City. And what they ended up getting is more luxury apartments.
Hmm.
You have companies like Goldman Sachs that are hiring tremendous numbers of people. Well, those people make good money, and they want nice places to live. And so if you're a builder, you're incentivized to build nice places, and you're having no problem filling them.
And just if you look at the national portrait, there's a lot fewer wealthy people in this world than the rest of us trying to pay a normal rent. And so is there an oversupply of luxury apartments?
No, that's the thing. We haven't hit an oversupply of anything. We have the lowest vacancy rates that we've had since we've been keeping track. So there, you know, of any income level, we're building and people are renting it. And we're seeing that throughout the valley. I thought this was particularly interesting is some of the south end of the valley cities have huge apartment buildings and they're charging more rent than Salt Lake City's charging because their apartments are slightly bigger. So, you know, you build a big apartment complex in Draper and you're having no problem getting top-notch rent because you can offer a little bigger place than you could in downtown Salt Lake City.
Yeah, but the commute.
Yeah.
You mentioned that interesting quote by Amy Fowler, Salt Lake City Councilwoman, saying, you know, we're not going to build our way out of this. I thought another interesting one from the article came from those analysts at the U saying that, you know, various factors seem to have temporarily suspended traditional rules of supply and demand. And those, as you pointed out, are just the idea of luxury apartments going up or the fact that, what are those factors? Why can we not build our way out of this? And what's the sort of solution?
Well, so there's some of the factors people would look at as a good thing is that this is a quality place to live, so people want to be here. That there are jobs so that people are attracted to jobs. They need a place to live, so they're moving here. I think there's some positives in that area. The challenge is, though, I mean, if you want to live in Salt Lake City, it's harder than it used to be. And you might not get the place you want, or you might have to find another city to live in and commute, as you pointed out. Some of the solutions beyond just building more buildings. Salt Lake City has made it easier to build what we call a mother-in-law apartment. That could either be in a basement, on top of a garage, or even like a detached unit in a backyard. They made it easier, but it's still difficult. And we're starting to see some of those come online. The other thing they talked about is rehabbing existing buildings into making them more than one unit. And we see that in a lot of major cities across the United States. Big houses turned into three apartments. We'll see if that is an idea that the city tries to incentivize going forward, is to create more density within the existing buildings themselves.
I mean, if Salt Lake City wasn't building all of these new apartment buildings, would the picture be worse? Do we have a way of answering that question?
Well, so people who build, they want to make money. And they're going to do a forecast to say, is there a demand here? And I think that's this, you know, a little bit of a chicken and the egg. Salt Lake City is attracting new businesses. And people want, or people want to live in Salt Lake City and they commute to businesses outside. We actually have a little bit of a reverse trend. We talk a lot about Silicon Slopes here. Well, a lot of people who move from California to come to the Salt Lake Valley to work in Lehigh, they're used to living in a city, and they like the benefits of a city, like going to the theater and the symphony, and they like the nightlife of it. And they can just jump a commuter train and head down there to work and then come back and live in the city. And so it's actually having pressures, just the growth throughout the whole metro area, on where do you want to live? And I do think that we see that in all of our lives. You tend to recreate and really experience the neighborhood in which you live in. And so people are making that choice. Younger Utahns are more interested in living downtown than past generations, which were much more single-family homes and looking in that area. We're also seeing growth there, too. But because we have a diversity of people and we have jobs for them, this is not something you can hold off.
George Pyle, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, you know, we've got all these apartments going up. They're not having an impact on the cost of housing in Salt Lake City. What's the point of all these buildings then? You know?
Well, these buildings are responding to market forces, as we've been saying. And so the thing that always bothers me is that they talk about this is a market rate rent, a market rate apartment, and over here is an affordable apartment. If the free market worked, those would not be two separate things. Those would be the same thing. Market rate and affordable would be synonymous. They're not. They're further and further apart all the time. We have the influx of population. The people at Envision Utah point to generations of people who like living downtown, who are happy renting. They could buy a house. They're rich enough. They could buy a house, but they choose not to because they like apartment living. They like the nightlife. They like the idea that they won't necessarily live here forever. A lot of these people that work for Silicon Slopes or Goldman Sachs or places like this are on a career path. They may not live here their whole lives. They may just be passing through up the corporate ladder. So they're less interested in sinking a lot of money into a purchase of a home, and they're happy with the apartments. The city is aware of this. I think the county is aware of this. They're going to have to start putting their thumb on the scale and giving incentives, and they're working on it now through the RDA, for convincing some of these developers to build or make a share of their buildings what they call affordable apartments. And they've tried this forever, every place. New York has rent controls. California, the big problem there is homelessness and lack of housing. That's why a lot of them are moving here. They're starting to do this. They're probably going to have to do it more. The problem is that even if the city is willing to help, even if the city gives a big tax break, even if the city says, okay, you don't have to build as much parking, you don't have to do this, you don't have to have the kind of setbacks that we used to have, it's still pretty bleeding expensive to build these things and turn a profit. So unless you like, even if you give the developer free land, and the city owns quite a bit of land, even then, you're coming close to not making it pencil out.
And Matt, just to kind of wrap this up, I mean, the basic picture is that there's not, despite all of this building, you know, rents aren't going down, but there's also not a lot of available units out there for people to get into.
No, which allows people to church more. And we're seeing that across the board. One of the quotes in this story was that there from this story was from Tony Simrad, by the way, was that that they're overly expensive, but there's also just under supply, even with this huge building boom that we've all experienced.
And so urging, you know, more rehabilitating existing housing stock downtown in the city, you said that's one of the solutions they've got. George is talking about RDA creating incentives for affordable housing. Is that the end of the recommendations from these analysts?
Essentially, that's the menu, is build more, incentivize affordable housing, mother-in-law apartments, and maybe rehabbing existing buildings. That's a new one.
Okay. Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, thank you for this. We are going to head to another break in the show. Wow, that's loud. Sorry. When we come back, we've got the story you've all been waiting for, a topic that is a polemic in Salt Lake City, scooters on sidewalks. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members. An American Festival Chorus and Orchestra and the Women of the USU Choirs, celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Utah women's rights to vote and the 100th anniversary of the passing of the 19th Amendment. Friday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m., part of USU's Year of the Woman.
Aaron Copeland went to an all-night dance hall in Mexico City. He saw a sign that read, "Please don't throw lighted cigarette butts on the floor so the ladies don't burn their feet." It's music inspired by that stimulating dance club on the next Performance Today from APM.
Tonight at 9 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb. This week, our show is all about passing the torch from one generation to the next, on family farms and family restaurants, and even in how we write and think about food. We've got Ruth Reichel and Soleil Ho, Ed Levine and Kenji Lopez-Alt, and much more. It's coming up on The Splendid Table from APM.
Join us Sundays at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Behind the Headlines. This is the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined by this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Taylor Stevens, and George Pyle. We invite you to join us with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, electronic scooters. They have been here in Salt Lake City for more than a year now, I believe. They are everywhere. Someone fed them after midnight, and they are now multiplying. To begin this conversation, well, let's do the public service announcement. Where are you allowed to ride your scooter, and where shouldn't you be riding them?
All right. So you should be riding your scooter in protected bike lanes and in the streets. You should not be riding your scooter on the sidewalk per city ordinance, city code, actually. There's no formal ordinance as of yet that is governing the use of scooters.
So you are not allowed to ride on sidewalks yet. I believe if we went to Main Street, Salt Lake City right now, we would see a lot of that going on. And so the director for transportation for Salt Lake City says that it may be time for some kind of action on that front. What kind of action is being talked about?
Yeah, so, I mean, we talked about scooters constantly last summer, right? When they were new and everybody was kind of trying to figure out what they were and how they worked. But in the year since, it's, you know, settled down a little bit. We haven't really talked about scooters in the last few months, although people continue to ride them on the sidewalks. And that is a problem that is ongoing for residents in the city who say that they don't feel safe on the sidewalks, that they've been run over.
There have been accidents.
A lot of those have to do with like falling. And I think, you know, the reason why people ride them in the sidewalk is because maybe they don't feel safe in the streets, which I think is also understandable. You know, there's not a ton of protected bike lanes in Salt Lake City. But anyway, all of this kind of adds up to the city's transportation director sending an email this week to the four scooter providers in Salt Lake City, basically warning them that the era of, you know, kind of no rules.
The wild west of scooterdom.
The wild west of scooterdom may soon come to an end, that the city is working on a formal ordinance to regulate the scooters, and that they're really sick of the sidewalk ridership, he said in his email. Quote, there is a sense that scooter riders feel entitled to the sidewalk, even when the sidewalk is crowded and even when they are next to a dedicated bike lane. So, you know, is this a problem if they don't know about the rules? They don't care about the rules? I'm sure it depends on the scooter rider, but it's become enough of an issue that the city feels it needs to address this directly and head on.
Yeah, I was going to say, but, you know, whether or not they know or care, it probably doesn't make as big of a difference as enforcing a policy would from, say, a ticketing standpoint or something like that. Is that what we're imagining might be coming?
You know, the city has been working, as I said, on this formal ordinance, and the council hasn't seen a copy of it. I haven't seen a copy of it. It hasn't been transmitted from the administration quite yet. So we're not really sure exactly what this might look like. However, the city did mention that it's working on a few different ideas. One of those is a, quote, walk your wheels campaign to try and help do some public education. The city's also really considering limiting operations to one or two scooter vendors. Right now we have four. And the reason for that is they want to give operational control to someone who can show results in limiting sidewalk ridership. They say that would be one of the top criteria for selecting their top one or two.
That's how they would decide, is who is preventing people from riding their scooters on the sidewalk. How would that be measured?
You know, I'm not sure exactly. We haven't seen any kind of rubric. That wouldn't necessarily be the only factor. However, they say that that would be a highly weighted factor. Another thing they're looking at are mandatory slow zones, scooter-free zones, curfews, just implementing a host of, you know, tighter regulations to kind of keep these problems at bay.
Curfew meaning you couldn't ride it late at night? Is that?
Yeah, and it's my understanding that some of the scooter providers already have, you know, like 10 p.m. your scooters go up and the catchers can go out and grab them and charge them. So I don't think that they necessarily want them to be ridden at night. However, there hasn't been much enforcement on that front.
How are these companies, you know, that by the way, did just kind of the first one to come to town just dropped all of these scooters without even consulting with the city? How are the companies responding to the idea that there might be greater enforcement or the request for additional work on that sidewalk scooter riding?
Yeah, I wasn't able to talk to all four companies. Spin, which is relatively new to Salt Lake City, said that, you know, it argues it's spending among the most time and resources working on this problem. They point to this funding of an intersection refresh they did recently at 3rd East, 7th South. And then they say they're planning to, you know, place stickers on their scooters to get that message across in the app, through emails. You know, basically this idea of, like, yes, we don't want people riding in the sidewalk either. This is something that we're working on, something that we want to address as well. Lime also said, you know, in-app notifications, stickers, the sort of the...
Nobody's suggesting thing. Electric shocks when you get on the sidewalk on their
scooter. That's not on the table yet.
Okay. All right. You know, there was one interesting thing. A person you spoke to... Oh, sorry. You haven't finished with who else you spoke to from...
That was it, actually. Okay. I couldn't reach the other two, so...
Great. I thought that this was interesting. One person who had been in communication with the mayor's office on this said, hang on a second, cars are the problem, not the scooters. Can you tell us about that sentiment, Taylor?
Yeah. This is Mike Christensen, executive director of the Utah Rail Passengers Association. Basically says, you know, I wish this much concern was being shown to cars because they pose a bigger threat. You know, if you get hit by a car, you're going to be a lot more injured than if you get hit by a scooter, for example. And so, you know, transportation Twitter, as I like to call it, you know, transportation advocates, people who are really focused on these issues, you know, they point a lot to cars. And the fact that cars are sort of taken for granted and these scooters are a novelty, so we're more focused on the dangers from scooters than we would be from cars and the way that cities are designed. I also promised somebody on Twitter, Dave, at Wandering Dave, that I would mention. Mm-hmm. He tweeted to me when I mentioned that we were all going to be talking about scooters. He said, obligatory cars are the real issue / threat to public safety, not e-scooters tweet. I told him I would bring that into the conversation.
Cars
are the problem for a lot of people, and they think, why are we focusing so much resources on scooters?
Well, status quo. I mean, we're speaking to the sort of how things have been designed. George Pyle, I'm going to give you the last word because we got to head to our underplayed stories here in just a minute. But two things there. One, just maybe we're focusing on the wrong thing, but also scooters on sidewalks. I mean, you can do it right. You can still have the scooters and do it right. Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, as has been mentioned, if you're on a scooter and you're saying, okay, the rule is I'm supposed to be in the street, that's really dangerous. I could get hit by a car, so I'm going to go on the sidewalk. The worst that could happen is I'll run into a pedestrian, and that's bad, but it's not as bad as me getting squished by 3,000 pounds of car, and so which is... In a way, not new, because we've had this with bicycles forever. And, yeah, we've had all this fuss between people who drive cars blaming the bicyclists and people who ride bicycles blaming the cars. And one of the reasons that the market and, to some degree, the city want scooters is so maybe we can have fewer cars, especially for short trips.
Yeah.
But, they showed up. They invented something that the law hadn't anticipated, so we're having to catch up. They decided it was better to ask forgiveness than permission. Now they're going to have to get permission.
Here we are a year and a half later trying to sort through it. Taylor Stevens, I'll have people check out your article at sltrib.com. Right now, though, we need to turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. Matt Cannon, we haven't heard from you in a little while, senior managing editor of the Tribune. What's your pick for underplayed story?
Aaron Alberti today put a question and answer together about the vaping-related illnesses that have happened in Utah.
Sorry, this is Aaron Alberti. We missed the beginning part of your statement. So she put together this story. Go ahead.
Yes, it's a question and answer of the vaping-related illnesses in Utah. We have the worst rate of these in the nation. This is what, if you vape or are concerned about this, we answer the most important questions, and that's available online.
Check it out at sltrib.com. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story.
You know, I don't know how underplayed this is, but Brian Maffley had a story this week about Solitude, which will begin charging for parking this year. The other ski resorts in the area are not going to follow through, but we'll see if this experiment works at helping alleviate some of the gridlock up there.
Some of the congestion in the canyons on the way up to the resort. And they're offering a discount for people who are
carpooling. Yeah. And you can always take the bus.
Okay. That's Taylor Stevens' pick. George Pyle, do you have a pick for underplayed story of the week?
Well, I don't know how underplayed it is, but
sure.
I'd like to throw some props to Mike Brown, Salt Lake City Police Chief, and his predecessor, Chris Burbank, who have both signed this letter put out by the Law Enforcement Immigration Task Force, trying in English and in Spanish to reassure people that local police are not ICE, they are not immigration agents, they wish to enforce the law without fear or favor, and if you are an immigrant, legal or illegal, and you're worried about being reporting a crime or coming forward as a witness to a crime, and you won't do it because you're or going to the emergency room and you won't do it because you're afraid the police will arrest you and deport you. Well, ICE might, but the Salt Lake City Police Department and many other police departments across the country will not, and they're really trying to get that word out because it just makes the police's job harder if they have that reputation.
Long-standing precedent here for the Salt Lake City Police Department in terms of how they enforce or don't enforce, that is, anything to do with immigration. For my part, I'm going to go with, again, not underplayed, but with the climate strike that's happening today. It's just something that's inspiring. The protesters saying, do something, do more, do it now. And that's what the science tells us we need to do. What that means, you know, an overhaul of transportation and energy systems, probably a reworking of our economies as well. And that kind of change only comes with huge public will forcing those changes. And that's the pressure that I think millions of people will be trying to bring to bear during today's Global Action on Climate Change. There's a rally just across the street from us at the Salt Lake City and County Building that begins at noon and then I think makes its way to the state capitol. Should be interesting to witness. George Pyle, Matt Canham, Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you in part by our members and Intermountain Healthcare, a not-for-profit healthcare system with 23 hospitals and 170 medical clinics located throughout the Intermountain West. Intermountain Healthcare also offers managed care under the insurance brand Select Health. Information at intermountainhealthcare.org.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.